extending her comeback on the World Cup circuit. Just a day after making history, the 41-year-old finished second in a downhill race in Switzerland. Vonn returned to competition last season after knee surgery. Downhill is considered the fastest and most dangerous event in alpine skiing. I'm Windsor Johnston, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org.
Well, it is quite a December Saturday morning as the temperatures plummet here on the Augustana College campus. And you're just in time, though, friends, for a nice cozy conversation with this week's guest, Dr. Mark Safestrom from Augustana College. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you'll join us here on WVIK for local radio, the way it's meant to be brewed, right here on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. Yes, we are very much beholden to tradition here, Dr. Safestrom. That is the original theme music for Saturday Morning Live. But thank you for coming in on a very cold day.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
But it's a very special day, of course. This is Santa Lucia Day in Sweden, which is a big deal. And we're going to get to that in just a moment. But first, I've just got to be my normal nosy self. My Swedish grandmother told me that it was a condition known as nyfiken, to be a little bit too nosy, but that's what I'm stuck with. How did your path land you here? And let's go all the way back to the very beginning. I don't know where you grew up.
Sure thing. Yeah. So I'm from the Seattle area. My roots are in the Swedes of the Pacific Northwest. And so in terms of the question of how I got into being a professor who teaches Swedish and Scandinavian studies, that also goes all the way back. Both sides of my family have roots in Sweden and in Finland, and we had lots of traditions growing up in Seattle. So three of my grandparents grew up in this country, but with Swedish as their first language.
Right. Well, I'm anxious to hear about that, to see how our childhood traditions sort of meshed, because I've always found it fascinating that Swedish Americans tend to hold on to traditions that Swedes evolved out of about 100 years ago.
Yeah, lots of examples.
Exactly, and that's what we think of. But when did you first have a chance even to take Swedish? I mean, was that not until the collegiate years, or how did that happen?
So, in high school, one of the options we had was German. Mm-hmm. So I took lots of German in high school, was even an exchange student. And I think when I was deciding what language to take in high school, German seemed close to Scandinavia, so that was one of the...
High school. But you were an exchange student? Did you get to travel?
Yeah, so for a month in high school, I lived in Cologne.
Köln, what a beautiful, beautiful city.
Yeah, a little suburb, Bergisch Gladbach. And it was one of these transformative experiences that we hope that students have when they're studying abroad, whether in high school or in college, where you get to kind of be there long enough to not be a tourist.
Mm-hmm. I do want to get into that a little bit about what we do for citizens of this country by giving them exposure to other countries. And we'll come back to that in just a little bit. But by the time then you got into college, were you thinking about this as a calling, or how did that all come to pass?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was maybe a vague idea. Definitely when I was picking out colleges, I wanted to study Swedish. And I knew some older kids growing up who had gone to North Park University in Chicago, which has an exchange program with a little college in Jönköping, Sweden. I ended up doing exactly that. But at the time, I wanted to be a high school history teacher. So I was planning, I knew I was going to study history. And then the Swedish and Scandinavian studies was kind of like the hobby that got out of control. And so I was a double major, in which kind of positioned me well to do graduate school later on.
Now, I think it might be instructive, at least for me, if we could talk a little bit about North Park and the movement that kind of created it. Just like sure. Augustana was created by one group of Swedish immigrants who tended to be more following a trajectory that might have been set by the Church of Sweden, which was more of a Lutheran type of body. Mm-hmm. In Sweden, there was also another movement, the Mission Friends, that created mission covenant churches in this country. Tell us a little bit about sure. that history, how it started and grew to be distinct from other immigrant movements.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said about the importance of the religious denominations for lots of immigrant groups. You know, this is their rallying point, and you know they found all these different schools and seminaries. And just as you mentioned, of course, the kind of the mainstream Swedish Lutherans who came to this country ended up in the Augustana Synod, the Augustana Lutheran Synod, and there's several schools, of course, that have connections to that in addition to Augustana, so Gustavus and Bethany and others. So similar to that, actually the second largest religious organization founded by Swedes was the Swedish Mission Covenant in this country, and it was a revival group that came up out of the Swedish state church, the Church of Sweden, and was happening over there in Sweden, but also was happening here among the immigrants who were wanting a little bit more latitude to worship and to conduct school and all of that the way that they saw fit. So, but of course, as is evident even in my own background, there's all kinds of entanglements. So, you know, I have a kind of a dual heritage from both kind of the Church of Sweden and even Augustana, as well as the Swedish Mission Covenant.
I've always found it somewhat interesting that you talked about the ethnic groups that would come over and religion was a rallying point, right? But you don't see, huge splits, say, in the Italian-American community. It was Catholic. I mean, it was... That was your choice. And there are some obvious exceptions to every rule, but that tended to happen. And then you get into the United States and the English might have been Methodist or they might have been more Scottish Presbyterian and then Baptists, you know, mm-hmm. growing and all that kind of thing. But it's so funny that for such a small group, the Scandinavians came up with these their own sort of splits, right? And distinctions that they found very important. And so that they cultivated when they were here.
Sure thing. Yeah, yeah. And I think as often it's kind of the case is that some of these more charged conversations in the 19th century become much more amicable in the 20th century, mid 20th century, as I think ecumenical movement is moving. And so there's, historians talk about entanglements and entangled histories, and I feel like that's a good way of describing the overlapping groups in this country. Lots of students who started out at North Park in Chicago, for instance, finished their degrees at Augustana mm-hmm. or other schools.
Well, in its early years, it was a two-year college. Yeah. So even a former president of this college, Tom Treadway, and a former national broadcaster, Dr. Timothy Johnson, who was the medical editor for ABC News, started 2 years in Chicago and then 2 years finishing at Augustana. So it was done
Indeed.
Quite commonly, I think.
And I think that that's another kind of aspect of the ethnic community is that you kind of trust what they have to offer at Augustana because at the very least they're Swedes.
Well, and that was the other thing that I find very, very fascinating is, again, to pick on my dear friends who are Italian Americans, you didn't see maybe just a little bit of a prideful distinction between a Milanese and a Sicilian, right? They're different parts, and they had dialects that were very, very different. But, you know, the Swedes, the Norwegians, the Danes, they wanted to be very distinct. And the Finns. I mean, they wanted to have their own distinctive identity. And the first three, at least, have languages that are very similar. Mm-hmm. And yet they wanted to maintain those individual identities. So that it was okay to come to Augustana because it might have been Swedish, but heaven forbid you would have gone to a Norwegian school.
But there's examples of that as well.
Sure, absolutely. Entanglements.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's also kind of interesting to think about how some of these, even the distinction between regional differences within Sweden, when the immigrants first came here, sometimes they set up a club for only people from their province. Mm-hmm. And then they realized that that might not be that sustainable. So they got a little bit broader. But then you also had the efforts to kind of have things for all Scandinavians, mm-hmm. Which kind of makes practical sense, seeing as a lot of us who have Scandinavian roots have in-laws or uncles who are Norwegian or Danish, so we on the ground we see how entangled all of this lovely history is.
Well, I have to though tell the family story that when my beloved uncle Harold Sundelius brought home his intended Charlene Swanson, no relation, his mother, my grandmother, shook her head as they left and said, "It'll never work. It's a mixed marriage," because Char was Norwegian. and of course, they wound up having a 60-year marriage.
Of course they did.
Yeah, of course. And there was one of the greatest relationships I've ever seen. But that was very real mm-hmm. to their parents. That was a very, very different thing. Okay, so I don't want to get too far off track here, but now, as you're thinking about a career teaching, and then history was the thing, it is the case that whereas just about every high school in America has a Spanish teacher, many have French, many have German, you're not going to find many places teaching Swedish. How did you then evolve from thinking about teaching history to finding a career path in teaching Scandinavian?
That's a great question. As I mentioned, I think I had the inclination to be a teacher, even already in high school, and I think it really comes down to when you are a student and really enjoy a subject, and then you kind of start to picture yourself. Maybe I could do what my teacher does because they do a great job, or cultivate the experiences that we had on a study abroad trip, and so you start to picture yourself. When I went to Sweden, I stayed for a fall semester in Jönköping, Sweden. And we had these class trips where we went and spent a week in Greece because we were taking a history or a course on Western civilizations. And you're visiting the Parthenon and you're going to Delphi and the Peloponnese and all of this stuff. And you just realize what a gift your professors are giving you when they've cultivated this itinerary and they want to show you all these things and then you make all of these wonderful friends that last a lifetime because you went through this kind of great adventure that one does when you're studying abroad. So I think that's really what plants the seed for those of us who really fall in love with teaching. Is that how can I cultivate those types of experiences for this generation of students?
Right, but to go on in Scandinavian, you didn't have a vast field. So where mm-hmm. did your studies take you after North Park University?
Yeah, so I was totally clueless when it came to graduate school. Now I can, looking back, I we have the language of kind of first generation. I was not the first in my family to go to college, but I was the first in my extended family to get an advanced degree. Now looking back, I realize I didn't have the people to ask, how do you do this? Or why would one do it? It's another 6+ years, maybe, that you're going to be working on your master's and your PhD. How do you navigate that? And I probably wouldn't have considered it at all if I hadn't had two professors in particular, Anne-Marie Andreasen, who was my Swedish professor at North Park, as well as Cal Catter, who was one of my history professors at North Park, each kind of independently give me the nudge saying, you should consider graduate school because you probably have what it takes, that's a boon to a student because you realize that somebody else has confidence in you.
Well, and it's often that's what we need, right? When we use that language of vocation, we need that external nudge pushing us in the right direction.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah? Exactly.
Well, so when you're looking then at graduate programs, if I'm not mistaken, there was one in your backyard. Have it at the University of Washington in Seattle?
They do, yeah. And so, you know, I'm like a ping pong ball going back and forth between the Pacific Northwest and the Midwest. But the University of Washington in Seattle has a centuries-old Department of Scandinavian Studies. One of probably the top three R1 universities that have Scandinavian Studies, you know, you could add to that list Wisconsin-Madison or University of California, Berkeley as well. So that was kind of an easy application to mail in, and that just felt right.
And is that where you went?
And that's where I went. So
all
I was
right
there.
So when it became time to be thinking about dissertations, what was catching your fancy? Because there's a lot of aspects to it. You can be thinking about immigration. You can be thinking about business. You can be thinking about history, all kinds of music, everything. What started to narrow your focus?
Yeah, well, this is the kind of the opportunity as well as the peril of being in an interdisciplinary field like Scandinavian Studies is that you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of narrowing it down, it really made an important difference that there was a historian at the University of Washington, Tarja Leiren, a Norwegian historian, who kind of gave me a nudge, kind of knowing my background, that I had kind of this Swedish and Swedish Mission Covenant background. You know, why don't you study the member of parliament whose name was Paul Peter Waldenström, Waldenström with a W.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a member of parliament in the Swedish Riksdag in the late 1880s and into the early, first decade of the 20th century. And that was a great prism to think about the immigrant experience is how does kind of religious influence and political ideology, how do they mix and meet in a small dynamic country like Sweden?
Mm.
What are the similarities with kind of the political experience in the United States with democracy? I was fascinated by this question about democracy and kind of its origins in the Swedish case because Sweden is kind of a latecomer to parliamentary politics. And it's really not until about 1914, 1915 that you have kind of the so-called breakthrough of democracy in Sweden. And of course, you know, all eyes are looking at the United States at that time, you know, like a lot of European countries, watching the democratic experience. And so that was a great way to think about immigration as well, you know, the migration of ideas.
Right. Well, I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of ideas migrating ahead of us. My guest is Dr. Mark Safestrom from the Scandinavian Studies program here at Augustana College. But this is also a time we step aside for another very, very famous Scandinavian, and that is Dr. Roald Tweet. And this is the time each week where we get another dose of Rock Island Lines.
This is Roald Tweet on Rock Island. For the past 10 years, Rock Island has suffered a plague of those silly signs now seen almost everywhere, signs with little red X's that say, "You are here." Of course I'm here. A more difficult question is why? Why are we where we are? Why do some of us end up in Moline, Illinois, or Fairbanks, Alaska, or Cutbank, Montana? Did you ever dream as a child that you would end up at 221 Elm Street in Stillwater, Oklahoma? For most of us Rock Islanders, as for you perhaps, the reasons are accidental. We can afford the house on Elm Street, or it will impress our friends, or it just happened to be for sale. Whether the landscape is flat or hilly or wet or cold or wooded makes little difference. And so we move restlessly, an average of once every 5 years, floating like dandelion seeds as jobs and fortunes change. But there are men and women living on this earth who plant themselves deep. For them, place is everything. Those with mountains in their soul find rocky places. Those in whom the ocean rolls come to live by shores. More than a few with rivers in their veins have come to Rock Island to live in small cottages or cabins on the floodplain. River rats, we call them when we notice them at all. They have been called to the river, and they accept whatever fortune the river sends, fish and floods, sunsets and cool breezes, cakes of ice in winter. If you watched the news media cover the 1993 flood at Rock Island, you saw these river rats confound the reporters who expected to record anger and despair and hopelessness. "Are you going to leave and never return?" a reporter asks. "Leave," says a woman whose house along the Rock River has been flooded 5 times already. "Leave? It's my home." And you may have seen the old gentleman in his rocking chair on a front porch, water up to the rockers, holding his hands out across the record Mississippi flood, and say, "Look at the view I've got. That is a river rat."
Rock Island Lines with Roel Tweet is underwritten by Augustana College, Rock Island, Illinois.
And we get to hear master storyteller Roel Tweet each and every week here on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded thanks to listeners just like you who become members. It's because we have a 90.3 FM, 95.9 FM in Dubuque and WVIK.org that we're able to guarantee we still have a home for Roel Tweet and Rock Island Lines. Now, Dr. Safestrom, Mark Safestrom, is here with me this week. Did you have much chance to interact? I know you were on Scribbles with Tweet, but did you have much chance to interact with him?
Just a little bit, you know, being on the program.
Yeah. Well, he was delightful in all ways, and he kept Swedish egos in line. As a fiercely proud Norwegian, he always had a little bit of a prank or a trick or something to pull on those smug Swedes to keep them in line. But, you know, he always played along, was a good sport, and in one of those ways was playing along with Santa Lucia. So You and I are chatting today, December 13th, happens to be Santa Lucia Day. And there are, like other things, there are ways that it's celebrated by descendants of immigrants here that are distinct from in Sweden. But I will tell you, you may have missed the glory years, because even as late as like 1969 and 70, it was an all-campus event here at Augustana, and Centennial Hall would be filled. And when I was, I think, 4 or 5, I was, every year there were 2 Stjärngossar, star boys, that were selected as the, they would accompany the Santa Lucia, who was invariably in those days a woman chosen, usually of Swedish extraction, which were pretty easy to find at Augustana in those days. But there were so many little traditions. She came to the houses of the 2 star boys on the morning and served them rolls. So I have this picture. I don't even remember this, but I have a picture my parents took. I'm just dead asleep. And there's this young Augustana student with candles in her hair leaning down, giving me a roll.
Yeah, you have no idea what's going on.
I have no idea what's going on. I do remember, however, that I lost a tooth that day, because the dear Betsy Brodahl would never let me forget about this into my, you know, advanced age, that I was walking around the whole time. Yeah, I was happy to have the star boy wand and the cap, but I was mostly proud to show my tooth that had fallen out to all of these distinguished guests.
Yeah, isn't that interesting, all the small details that you remembered?
Yeah,
it was
exactly.
The tooth that you remembered.
It was the tooth. But Santa Lucia continues to be observed to this day here at Augustana, but it's really not the way things are shaken today in Sweden. Tell us a little bit about what Santa Lucia Day would look like in Sweden. And let's see, this is Saturday morning, so we're into Saturday afternoon over there, so...
Yeah, so of course, you know, historically, Lucia is associated, the tradition is associated with the morning. So if you go back, you know, in a couple hundred years, it was really a Western Swedish tradition in provinces like Värmland, where the oldest daughter would get up to serve the household their early breakfast. We sound like hobbits, that we have our early breakfast and our later breakfast. But that's how it was on the farms in Sweden.
But it was going to stay dark till 9 or 10, so
exactly.
Take your time.
Yeah, so it was really kind of a tradition that you did in the home.
Yeah.
And there's, of course, lots of people who do that still. They do something at home with their family, and maybe especially with small children, they might get up and get to serve. You know, maybe one parent helps the child serve the other parent, so it's kind of breakfast in bed.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of the older tradition. It was kind of in the 1920s that it became this big, you know, pageant and maybe even a parade type of an event in Sweden. And it was a department store that was promoting the holiday, and that really kind of kicked off this tradition of that we kind of know today, where you have a big Santa Lucia program, and it's in a church or in a hall, or maybe it's outside in a town square, and you have maybe somebody in the school is chosen to be Lucia, or you have some type of other way of winning that contest.
Is there not like a national Lucia as well?
Sure. Yeah. And one of the things that's common in Sweden today, and I would encourage listeners to check this out, is that they broadcast on television, on Swedish television. I think it's at 6 a.m. on the morning of the 13th, the year's Lucia program. And it's very, very well done, especially since the pandemic days, when these kind of virtual programs, you know, took the place of meeting in person. But it's a high production value, and it's an hour-long concert of Swedish Christmas carols sung by some choir from an area. So, it's kind of a way to feature local choirs. First and foremost.
And that is a big deal in Sweden, is choral singing.
Exactly.
Like every community has their choir, and not necessarily school related. It could be adults, seniors. I mean, but they're very proud of their choral tradition.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
And you can, listeners can go and find those on SVT Play. .se, so that's svtplay.se, or I think they also post them on YouTube.
Sure. And so right now, let's see, it is about 5:30 or so in the evening in Sweden, so you've missed the early morning stuff, but I bet you can watch highlights and something like that.
Mm-hmm.
This notion of, I was curious about it, because my understanding is, well, first off, the Swedes are stealing this from Sicily. There was an actual saint, Lucy, and there's of course, a gory story behind her martyrdom and sainthood and all this kind of stuff. But the quaint legend is that she was smuggling food to the besieged Christians in the catacombs, and so to have more space in her hands for food, she wore a crown of candles to light her way down to the caves. It's a great visual. But I've always been told that it was kind of a hallmark sort of commercialization, that they saw a profit motive in this in Sweden, and that's kind of where it took off.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about the kind of the, you know, how do we visualize something like, Santa Lucia, it's similar to kind of the way that, we had Father Christmas for a long time, but then he became Santa Claus as we know it because of advertisers like Coca-Cola and others, who kind of painted a picture for us that then stuck. And similarly with Lucia and other Swedish Christmas traditions, there's one illustrator in particular, Jenny Nyström, who you find all kinds of Christmas cards and paintings that she did depicting a scene like Santa Lucia, or the Christmas gnomes, the tomtar, who kind of come and bring your gifts in Sweden. And they have, they have red caps and big beards, and Lucia, you know, is always dressed in flowing white nightgown with a red sash. And a crown of candles on her head.
Yeah. And, I grew up, I bet you did too, with books of paintings by Carl Larsson, who was sort of kind of Sweden's Norman Rockwell of the 19th century.
He was.
And it was very authentic there. He painted his own family having its Santa Lucia celebrations. And it's quaint and it's lovely. I always love the way that cultures adapt, and move on. I think it's so funny that when it comes to Christmas traditions, in the land of reindeer, the animal most associated with the gift giving is a ram, a Yulebok, rather than, and that I think goes back to Thor, right? Didn't he?
There's a lot of Old Norse kind of precursors that kind of still persist within, current modern day or at least 19th century Scandinavian Christmas traditions. The Yulebok nowadays is depicted or made, fashioned out of straw.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of a Christmas decoration, and you kind of visitors to Scandinavia might be wonder why there's all these straw animals, but it makes sense if you're everything makes sense in context.
Yeah.
But the big thing that everybody pays attention to in Sweden is one particular gigantic straw Yule bock in the city of Gävle. North of Stockholm, and it's in, you know, out in the open in the town, and people find a way to burn it down every single year. And so other people kind of have, of course, they don't want them to burn down this gigantic straw structure, but people kind of take bets and make a sport out of guessing, you know, what day it will burn down during Advent. But
well, It was originally they meant to burn it on Twelfth Night, right? If you could make it till Twelfth Night, then you would have a great fire and do all that kind of stuff. Wasn't there, I seem to recall there was a year that, this is a very famous thing in Europe, but like a Chinese entrepreneur wanted to buy it and have it reconstructed back in China, but it got burned too soon.
Too bad, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. And then I seem to recall one year it survived the flames, but not the crows. The birds came and just, it was a very cold winter.
Well, although that is actually one of the reasons for making straw bouquets of straw and other things and hanging them out in your yard is it's to attract birds.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a bird feeder.
Sure.
You know, so that's another tradition in Sweden is to create something beautiful that birds can come and eat. And
well,
you can watch the birds.
It is a quaint tradition. There was a poem written by a 19th century Swedish poet, Victor Rydberg, and he kind of makes this tie that the gnomes were there to care for the creatures on a farm or a homestead or something like that. And then the legends would rise that if you were mean to your animals, the tomte would be mean to you. And if you were kind and caring. So yeah, the straw being all over the place, because there's not a lot of forage in Sweden in December and January.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you guys do Santa Lucia in your home growing up in Seattle?
Yeah, so we actually did it at church and grew up at the historic Swedish Tabernacle downtown in Seattle on Pike Street, which is now First Covenant Church.
Mm-hmm.
And for decades, there was, you know, on one of the first Sundays, well, Saturday and Sunday in the old days, there would have a Yule Fest is the name of the program. And it was a afternoon service where they had basically, they went through the whole Christmas season singing Christmas carols, you know, first of Advent and moving right on to Epiphany. And there was a Lucia portion in the middle of that. So everybody, you know, you're just at that point when you're a young kid, you're just being dressed up as a star boy. And,
yeah.
And you know,
you just go
why,
with
am
the flow.
Why am I wearing this and where am I going?
And these rolls aren't really as sweet as American donuts. Why do we have to keep eating these things?
Yeah.
The saffron buns
are a little bit bitter. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you used an interesting word, tabernacle. So I think a lot of people live in the Quad Cities their whole lives, and they don't realize that they can see that word in Swedish. If you're driving on the one ways, 7th Avenue in Rock Island, becoming 5th Avenue in Moline, just when you get into Moline, right by St. Mary's, which is a great Catholic church that's been there forever, their long ago neighbors, it says still on the top of the building, Missionstabernaklet.
It does.
The Mission Tabernacle, right? And then that, I think...
I salute every time I drive by.
Do you really? A special salute, yeah. And it's right in the middle of one of the most vibrant centers of our Mexican-American heritage of the Quad Cities, the heart of the Floreciente community. And there's that little flag of Sweden flying up there. It'll eventually, I'm sure, just fall apart.
It's in bad shape.
It's in bad shape. Some people have tried to fix it. But that tradition continues. And so does the whole Mission Covenant tradition. And one of the things I wanted to lift up with you is you are also a magazine editor.
I am.
In addition to many other things. Tell us about Pietisten.
Yeah, so this is kind of a literary journal community that goes back to the mid-1980s. And there was a group of mostly graduates of North Park in Chicago, but some Augustana folks as well, who have been kind of batting around this journal and publishing things that are interesting to them. And the common thread really is kind of the Swedish Lutheran, Swedish Mission Covenant tradition of an earlier newspaper also named Pietisten, in Sweden. And Pietisten means the pietist,
mm-hmm.
And was started by, the plot thickens. It was started by an English Methodist, George Scott, who came to Stockholm in the 1840s and recruited the young Carl Olaf Rosenius to be his assistant. And then, long story short, it becomes this rather significant
yeah.
publication in Swedish church history. And so when they rebooted this kind of North American small-scale artisanal variant of the publication, they're making an homage to that history.
And I got to say, it's got great writers and always had benefited from that. But we're going to dive into that a little bit further. First, though, we're going to talk, that was, I think you were alluding to a group of merry gentlemen who kind of worked on that. And they've gotten more diverse over time. But speaking of merry gentlemen, I wanted to share today, I love to find kind of weird things in terms of music. And one of my favorite artists today is a guy named Jean-Baptiste. And he does all kinds of stuff, and he always presses it just a little bit and makes you give it a closer listen, whether it's jazz or anything else. But I happen to find that a few years back, he recorded God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen in his own distinct way of doing God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. So for our Saturday morning jam this morning, we're going to have a chance to listen to, if I can find the right button here, there it is. I was on the wrong one. This is Jean-Baptiste and God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes with my guest, Mark Safestrom from Augustana College.
Thank you.
And that is John Batiste and his take on God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. I'm here with a wonderful gentleman right here now this morning, Dr. Mark Safstrom from Augustana College's Scandinavian Studies program. And I know we're going all over the map, but we were talking about Pietistin. Mm-hmm. And among the merry band that was putting that together was Tom Treadway, the former president of the college. And a poet who might have escaped broader notice if it weren't for Tom and a couple of other guys. Again, it was a North Park connection, but somebody they had gone to school with went on to become a UCC pastor, Art Mample, who was really a delightful poet. Yeah. Some of the poetry that he wrote probably might have been missed if it weren't for these guys. And there was somebody from the Twin Cities who was involved with the Schubert, a wonderful institution of the cultural arts in the Twin Cities, and some other folks from North Park. But it's an interesting journal, the things that you how do you pick what's going to be in a journal like that?
Well, yeah, you know, it starts with what people send us. So.
Okay.
But we, you know, the general scope of Pietistin is to kind of lift up kind of devotional material from the kind of Lutheran Pietist tradition. You know, so it could be they have had Bible commentaries. They've had, you know, we've had, you know, homilies that kind of have been repurposed for print. And but also, you know, you mentioned Tom Treadway, you know, historian and former president of Augustana College. Treadway's essays are beautiful kind of tours of Western civilization and you know, history of Christianity and. You know, politics and democracy. And so it is kind of wide ranging, but there is always that kind of touchstone of things that are kind of edifying questions that are kind of upbuilding spiritually and also, you know, have a literary and cultural interest to them.
Well, I do. I think it would be helpful because that word and its roots and piety, a pious person, have meanings in popular culture today that would be very foreign to our grandparents. Yeah. So in this context, what do we mean by piety or to strive for piousness? What were they talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think... you know, as a historian, but also someone who's, you know, kind of deeply connected to kind of the, you know, this Protestant tradition, you know, it maybe it's similar to the way that people today, you know, are looking for authenticity.
Yeah.
You know, so in the 19th century, as kind of democracy is opening up and you have more possibilities for kind of deciding how your local congregation is going to run itself, and you're going to have meetings and keep minutes, and you know, follow Robert's Rules of Order, and kind of chart your own destiny. You know, that kind of intersection between religious life and democratic, you know, praxis is one of the kind of, I think, the core questions that interested, you know, I guess people in the traditions that we've talked about already.
Yeah.
You know, Augustana Lutheran tradition and the Mission Covenant. But specifically the folks you mentioned, like Tom Treadway and Art Mample and others, that, you know, what does one have to do with the other? It's kind of the great question, you know, what hath Jerusalem to do with Athens?
Right.
You know.
And that's a recurring theme in a lot of Treadway's essays.
It's even the title of one of them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we had talked, we mentioned democracy again, and yeah, I think places like Sweden were a little bit late to the parliamentary democracy, but we actually kind of took our cue from them when it came to freedom of the press.
Mm-hmm.
The oldest free press protections come from Sweden. Tell us about that, oh historian.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of quirky the way it unfolds today.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's a good example of how, you know, if you're looking where you really can't find a linear kind of history of progress, really, in any, you know, Western European country's development. And, in you know, in the case of Sweden, during the kind of absolutist monarchy, you know, monarchies of the late 1700s, you have this anomaly, which is the establishment of the freedom of the press. You know, but then the other kind of advancements take a while longer to the kind of mid 19th century.
It was very revolutionary because an absolutist monarch, which most of them were at the time, if they didn't like something, not only did they ban the book, they often separated the head from the body of the writer. I mean, and it was, that seems rather revolutionary. And what I thought was interesting now is that it's, I think, still the case that one copy of everything that is published and disseminated in Sweden belongs to the crown.
Well, it's the Royal Library,
right?
You know, in particular.
Yes.
So this, the Kungliga biblioteket, or the Royal Library in Stockholm, has that mandate to collect everything printed in Swedish, but also kind of Swediana, so things about Sweden.
Yeah, and they've collected so many things, they have to, they've filled up a couple of mines with some of these things, because they have to accept a copy of everything.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place to do research and sit in the kind of beautiful reading rooms of the Royal Library in Stockholm. But they do have additional off-site storage because they have
so many things. Building in Sweden that could house everything that they've collected, because that law goes back to the 1700s. Prior to, I think, prior to our Constitution. But so that's something kind of interesting. I guess I'm always curious why a young person would want to engage in Scandinavian studies, but then the obverse. I mean, what do we have to learn from the Scandinavians, and what do the Scandinavians have to learn from us? You were talking earlier about this migration of ideas.
Yeah. You know, I think, of course, the first questions, you know, for students is oftentimes a practical one. You know, they, you know, as a good liberal arts college, Augustana, you know, expects that our graduates will have some basis in a language that's not their mother tongue, and so
right.
So they're looking around to fulfill a language requirement, and that we have a robust world languages program at Augustana College. We have 8 languages that you can study. French and Spanish, German and Japanese, Chinese and Swedish, and then ancient languages, Latin and Greek. So they've, you know, you've got all these options. Every one of those programs has, study abroad options where you can go on a faculty-led program with an Augustana faculty member or members, kind of to that part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Circling back to my own origin story is how did I get into, being a college professor? It was that sense of adventure, you know, that you can travel someplace else, and be there for a while, figure out how people live, you know, in that other country. And, you know, even as a high schooler, when in my first trip, you know, when I was in Germany, kind of returning to the United States, you have this view of your own homeland from the outside. And that's, it's kind of startling and exhilarating and eye-opening. And that's really the heart of, the experience that we want today's college students to have.
Yeah.
When they really, get their, roll up their sleeves and sift through, the cultural history and literature of a different, part of the world, you understand yourself that way.
Yeah. Okay. Help me unpack this wonderful little conundrum that Scandinavia is a highly content area. They always show up on the top of the happiness indices, and people are well-adjusted and peaceful for the most part. Yes, like any place, there's crime, but there's not a terrible amount of it. It's a relatively tranquil corner of the world. And yet, Swedish noir as a literary genre, Sweden's responsible for some of the goriest crime fiction you're ever.
Churn out the material. Yeah.
How does that? How do you explain that?
Well, I think you kind of it explains itself in a way, and is that you're kind of, maybe there's a fascination with the thing that isn't as common.
Right. Right.
And so if these relatively stable, peaceful societies seem to be fascinated by crime novels.
Sure.
And there's even the phenomenon of post-crime, or, your Easter crime novel, because you have a long weekend for Easter in Sweden, and maybe you're going to go up in the mountains and go skiing. And so you want to bring along some a gory book. Detective novel to, you know, curl up with.
Well, I love the fact that a famous Swedish writer, Camilla Läckberg, most all of her gory crimes are centered in her hometown, which happens to be an exceedingly quaint village called Fjällbacka on the west coast of Sweden. I've been there, and probably the worst crime that's ever occurred is jaywalking, but all of her terrible murders seem to be located. It's like Aledo, Illinois being the crime capital of the United States. It's a terrible, terrible
thing. Well, it's kind of like, you know, what is it, Jessica Fletcher and Cabot Cove,
you know,
the murder she wrote.
Or Louise Penny.
The whole town has been killed by
murderers. There's no one left. I love the Three Pines mysteries, the Canadian writer Louise Penny. Speaking of books, we're going to run out of time here, Mark, but what are you reading lately? Anything you'd care to recommend? I just finished, and I keep gushing about, Frederick Bachmann's My Friends.
Mm-hmm.
A delightful novel. But what have you been reading lately that you'd want to share with us?
Well, on the kind of crime fiction front, I got sucked into these Sidney Chambers mysteries. There's the Grant Chester series on PBS about this clergyman who teams up with the local police inspector to solve crimes in this another small town in this case outside of Cambridge in England, but it's based on the novels about the Sidney Chambers character. Yeah. So Sidney Chambers in the Shadow of Death.
Yeah, the hotbeds of crime. Now today we're celebrating Santa Lucia Day, but Christmas is coming up. Did you and your family celebrate with potato sausage?
Oh, we did indeed, yeah.
I think it's so funny because all of our Swedish family in Sweden, they wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. I mean, it's peasant food.
Yeah.
It's a huge part of our celebrations because we are descended from peasants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have, you know, of course, here at Augustana, we have a Yule board dinner that the community can come to and be part of, hosted by the Swenson Center, our archive of the Swedish-American immigrant experience.
With the American Scandinavian Association. I always want to give them a plug when
we
can.
Yes, of course. Yeah. And they, earlier in November, the ASA hosts a lutefisk dinner.
I knew you were going to say it.
So there's lots of Scandinavian farm food from the 19th century that you can have still here today
at
Augustana College.
I thought we could get through the whole show without mentioning lutefisk, but I did finally have some. Oh, goodness gracious me. All right. Well, I really want to thank you for spending a little bit of time with us this morning. And I would, one last question to put you on the spot. I aver that if you're going to watch a film version of A Man Called Ove, you watch the Swedish production and not the American A Man Called Otto, even with the great Tom Hanks. Would you agree?
Well, you know what? I've only seen the Swedish version.
That's
my homework. I need to go.
No. You don't need to see anything else. You don't need to see anything else. Anyway, with that, I want to once again thank my guest, Dr. Mark Safstrom from Scandinavian Studies at Augustana College. Thank you for enlightening us on this holiday of light, which is, of course, Santa Lucia. There's the light in her name. Yeah. And thanks for being with us as we had a chance to work through all of that. I'm just realizing that I didn't even start the theme music, but we'll get it started there. It's there. It'll start at the right time. Thank you for being with us. Today, by the way, is a good day to stay inside. Just so you know, snow is likely today to continue up to 1 to 3 inches. Temperature's only going to reach 9 degrees, mostly clear tonight with an overnight low around 8 below. So be very, very careful. Sunny and cold tomorrow, our high only reaching near 3. It's going to start warming up, and by Monday, mostly sunny, our high will get into the upper 20s. Right now, though, we want you to look ahead to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on WVIK, and be sure to join us next week when our guest will be Gary Stoppelman from the Dubuque Museum of Art, and that'll be right here on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. You can always find our podcast at WVIK.org, or tune into Quad Cities, NPR, WVIK, 90.3 FM and HD in Rock Island, and at 95.9 FM, K240DZ in Dubuque. Friends, we're coming up on 11 o'clock. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me right around the corner. A little bit of news from NPR, but we both hope that you have a wonderful Santa Lucia Day and that whatever holidays that you celebrate with your family and your friends and your neighbors, that they're all wonderful and warm. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.